This evening, as we continue our study of the Beatitudes, we are dealing with the peacemakers. You see, I sounded like something from back in the 60s, I guess, the title when I said peace, not war. Thought about starting out with an Edwin Starr song. Somebody tell me what that song is? Edwin Starr.
Yeah.
War! What is it good for? Absolutely nothing. Say it again. Edwin Starr. Way, way back in the 60s, early 70s. You were being pursued by a cougar. I guess we could have done something else, we could have made some protest signs about peace and not war. Seems like war is a common factor within the life of the world and has been for much of world history. Jesus is here talking in the latter stages of what is collected as the Beatitudes about being peacemakers. Verse 9 of Matthew chapter 5. Blessed are the peacemakers, for they will be called children of God. Peacemakers. And no, I'm not talking about a Colt revolver. I wrote that down here. But that was the peacemaker in the Old West. But interestingly enough, this is the only place in the entire New Testament where the noun for peacemaking or peacemakers is used. Hoi anerepoioi comes from irene in Greek, which means peace. And it's based in a large part on the Hebrew idea of shalom. If you were to go to the Greek text of many of Paul's letters, in the beginning of those letters, he wishes people charis kai irene in Iesu Christu. Charis, grace, which was a typical Greek or Gentile greeting. Kai and irene, peace, which typically within the Middle East, especially in Hebrew and Arabic countries, you either wish shalom when you greeted someone and shalom when you finished, or salam when you began and finished. So grace and peace in the Lord Jesus Christ. But this is the only place in the entire New Testament where the noun peacemaker is used. And yet that noun peacemaker also can be seen as pointing toward a verb. The verb to make peace. It does not mean those who live passive lives or lives of non-resistance. It doesn't mean those who say, well, I'm gonna become a hermit so that my life can be peaceful and sit back and enjoy that. And it's not speaking of people who live separate from others in peace for the soul purpose of enjoying the peace of the moment, enjoying the peace and quiet, though sometimes we really need that. We really had a good time with Sydney this weekend. She is an absolute joy. And when she comes running down the hallway and says, "Grand Doc," and jumps up in your arms, you know, there's nothing like that. However, Thursday night, we have a neighbor that's got a 5-year-old girl. And Sydney and Allie sometimes play together. So Thursday night, they came over to Grammy and Grand Doc's house and watched a movie. And then played for 2 hours, starting at 7, and then played for another hour before Allie went home. And Sydney brought all her dress-up things. I mean, people have given her or they've bought Disney costumes. Snow White, Ariel, yeah, that's the Little Mermaid, Tiana, the Princess and the Frog. Amazing that I've had to learn these things. Cinderella, Sleeping Beauty, and a couple of others. So they play dress-up. They had sleepover Friday night. a 4-year-old girl and a 5-year-old girl. Although Sydney dropped off about an hour before Allie did. Allie had never seen Aladdin before, so she was. And then Saturday morning, we woke up at 7 o'clock to Allie crying because she woke up and she was in a strange place and wanted Mommy and Daddy. But as soon as Sydney got up, they were playing. So, and then last night, we played again. Granddad, I'll be the princess, and you be the prince, and Allie, you can be, she said, I'll be a princess too. So, but you can knock on our door. And then we shot off some fireworks, sparklers and Roman candles and stuff. We enjoyed the peace and quiet after Allie went home and Sydney went to sleep for a little while. She's coming back for the 4th. So we're not talking about those, though, who just sit back and enjoy the peace and quiet or the fruits of peace just for themselves. It speaks of those who devote themselves to what really is a difficult task, especially in our world today. And in human relationships, if anybody tells you it is easy to live peacefully and peaceably with all their friends and all their family, you better move out of the way, because if they're kin to Pinocchio, that nose is going to grow and stab you right in the heart. Peace is not an easy thing to attain, and it's certainly not an easy thing to maintain. We may walk around each other and walk on eggshells to keep the peace. But is that really having peace? No. Because there is that undercurrent that goes on that keeps you from really having peace in those situations. It is difficult work as we seek to reconcile individuals, as we seek to reconcile families. And Lord knows, nations? You've got to be kidding. With hostility toward each other. And notice, Jesus didn't say, as I say here, Jesus didn't say, blessings on the peace lovers. The only way the peace lovers have blessing is if they are peacemakers. That is, we honestly go out seeking to make peace. Now, shalom is never only a negative trait. This comes William Barclay. Is shalom in Hebrew is never only a negative trait. It never means only the absence of trouble. In Hebrew, peace always means everything which makes for a man's highest good. In other words, when you wish someone peace, you greeted them, you wished them shalom, and when you departed, or you parted ways, you wished them shalom. The point was not that they would not have an absence of trouble, but rather that they would have the presence of good things and peaceful things. Not just the absence of bad things, but you wish upon, when you wished upon someone peace, you were wishing something good for them, for good things to come upon them. Also, if we think we will be creating peace when we refuse to face difficult situations and take the appropriate action demanded, we're fooling ourselves. I quote one New Testament scholar. The peace which the Bible calls blessed does not come from the evasion of issues. It comes from facing them, dealing with them, and conquering them, and I would say in the proper way, not the passive acceptance of things because we're afraid of the trouble of doing anything about them. But the active facing of things and the making of peace, even when the way to peace is through struggle. End of quote. That's the peace of which the Bible speaks. When God reconciles people to Himself, it is not through the avoidance of our sins and confrontation of our sins. In fact, for God, it was not anything passive at all. We truly believe in our hearts and our minds and our souls that God in Jesus did come to reconcile the world to Himself, one person at a time, for the whole world, and did indeed suffer all kinds of persecution and die. Yes, there is the resurrection. That's the last part of the good news, but the other part of the good news is that God came and suffered and died for us. If we believe that, then, and if we find that, then God making peace was indeed a through struggle. It was through struggle. Facing the rejection, facing the hatred, and facing the possibilities, or should I even say probabilities, that human beings would continue to reject, even after accepting a lot of times. We do things that would cause God pain and discomfort because we reject what we know we should be doing. God confronts us with our own sinfulness, and then we have a part in the struggle as to whether we admit the sin or not, as to whether we confess the sin or not, as to whether we truly seek to avoid the sin or not. You know, we oftentimes get to the point where we think we have peace because we beat our consciences to the point that we dull their senses and the conscience doesn't seem to bother us anymore. But that's not peace, because there's always that undercurrent. And so the peace that the Bible is talking about is blessing comes from not the evasion of issues, but from seeking to make peace, even if it is through struggle. Struggle for us and struggle together. I also think it's very ironic that Jesus spoke these words when the only peace that was in his country was the Pax Romana, Roman peace. And why was there Roman peace? Because the Roman army was bigger and badder and stronger than everybody else, and they were scared. So it was really an uneasy peace. And I would contend there really was no peace because of the undercurrent. The Romans tried to say there was peace in the kingdom, except on the outlying areas where they were still trying to conquer and that kind of thing. But in places like Jerusalem, there was no real peace. Sometimes I wonder if that's, you know, we talk about, I think it's interesting throughout world history, but even we, and I am very, very grateful for our military and for the freedoms that we have and for the freedoms that are protected, but sometimes we go into a country and we say we're going there to make peace, or we're just going as peacekeepers, but how do we make that peace, or how do we seek to keep that peace? Force of arms. Yeah. Violence. Threat. And it's really a difficult balance to try and find that. But it was maintained by the Romans through the threat of violence. So there really wasn't peace. They only fooled themselves into thinking there was peace in the Roman Empire. And in particular, in Palestine and Jerusalem. So I think it's very ironic that Jesus speaks these words when the only peace was that of threat of violence. And when, all around him, even in his band of 12, there was at least one zealot, I personally think two. And the zealots were about bringing about a military coup in the name of God, whether God was ready for it or not. I think that it's interesting, too, that Jesus, as we said when we first started here, when Jesus saw the crowds, he went up the mountain, and after he sat down, his disciples came to him. Then he began to speak and taught them, those 12, saying, this is how you'll be blessed. This is what God expects, with the expectation that they would help to share that. But he says this about peacemakers when he's got at least one zealot sitting there, and maybe two. So it's not directed as some abstract. It's directed directly to the concrete situation in which he lived, in which he faced, and which continues for us even today. Now, I like one of the ways William Barclay says that you could translate this passage. Blessed are those who make this world a better place for all men, S-I-C, all people, for all men, to live in. Although I would change that, a world, a better place for all in which all persons might live. But blessed are those who make this world a better place for all persons to live in. Some scholars contend that this beatitude means the person who makes peace in his own heart and soul will be blessed because of continuing war between good and bad within human nature. And I think that's a part of it. Before we make peace with somebody else, where's the first place we got to make peace? Within our own heart and soul. That's right. Within ourselves. That's right, Al. Within ourselves. We can't make peace with anybody else if we're at war within ourselves. So there's a constant struggle of not being at war within ourselves, making peace within ourselves, and then making peace with others. And just as soon as we think we've got that lit, lo and behold, we got another battle going on somewhere in ourselves. That's the Holy Spirit flying around back there, Ed. He's swatting. Yeah, I know. He's swatting at things, but those little flies. Now, once again, this is a whole lot easier to say than it is to do. But we do need to win this daily battle as we try to overcome the conflict and give over our whole heart to God. And we can say, we can go down front, Ashlyn, this morning, giving her heart to Christ. Well, she's already done that. She's already made that decision. But you know, how many times do we think we've given our heart to Christ? And down the road she'll learn. We've given it to Christ, and on one level we do, but we don't reach it all right there, do we? There are other places, even you know, as a 60-year-old, there are places that I say, oh, you know, I don't know that I really gave that over, that part of it over completely. Got a closet here, a sub-basement, a sub-sub-sub-basement, you know, that kind of thing. All kinds of little cubby holes in the attic. So it is a daily thing that we face. And if you know of someone who has made that and is still alive, please let me know. Because I want to go talk to them and I may even have them start preaching. We have to win that battle within ourselves before we can do it. And it means giving over our whole heart to God, which can take a lifetime. As I've said before, how many times do you think you've given something? God, I can't handle this anymore. I'm going to give it to you. And just as soon as we think God's turned his back and forgotten about it, we reach up to take it back off the shelf. The rabbis taught that the highest task of any person was to establish right relationships between persons, between individuals. You may or may not have noticed, English people probably have, but you may or may not have noticed that I a lot of times use person rather than people. Because we can see people and not really see the person. And it's about establishing right relationships between persons, not just people and people groups, but individuals. Bridging the gaps between those who enjoy causing trouble and others, even those victimized. And I think Jesus, in part, had this also in the forefront of his mind, looking back at his day, even looking at some of his disciples and some of the things that happened there with his disciples. There are persons who are always the storm center. And I'm not just talking about Mike Seidel or Jim Cantore on the Weather Channel. There are persons that always seem to be in the middle of the storm, right? In the storm centers of trouble, of bitterness, of conflict. Either they're involved in it or they're causing the quarrels. They always seem to be there. And not just out there, it happens even in churches, right? There are people that seem to always be kind of at the center of the storm, even in churches. Quoting William Barclay again, the man who divides men is doing the devil's work. The one who unites men is doing a God's work. Or I would say doing a work of God. There are people in whose presence bitterness seems to fester and grow. There are others in whose presence bitterness doesn't seem to be able to live. There are those who seem to be able to bridge the gaps between people, to heal those breaches, to try and overcome strife in a positive way. But that is probably some of the most difficult. I said earlier that doing the difficult work of making peace, some of the most difficult work is where those are involved in trying to overcome that in a positive way. You know, a lot of times, even in our trying to make peace, not just with the threat of war, but we use threat. If you don't get along, there was a point this past weekend where I said, if you two don't stop fussing over who's going to be the princess, who's going to be the prince, and who's going to be the dragon, one of you's going to sit on that corner, in that corner of the room, and the other one's going to go and sit in that corner of the room, and I'm going to sit in between you and dare you to say anything. As if a 4- and 5-year-old really understand that, but, you know, I'm bigger. So there were times when Stephen and his best friend Shane would be playing in the backyard, and they'd get at each other, and I'd actually make them. We had a fenced-in backyard, a place we were renting up North Greenville, and I would make one of them, and it was a big backyard too, and I'd make one of them go sit with his face in the corner of the fence right there, and the other one on the other end of the yard sit with his face in the corner, and I'd sit down in the lawn chair and read. Dare them to turn around and look at each other. I'd say, you got 30 minutes. Don't even turn around. Don't even think about it. That's tough. But it took something to get me there. Yeah, well, there weren't any fire ants, but. And I remember one of the times it was because we were playing ball. We played ball in the backyard, and I'd play against them. And of course, you know, one and two, and we play with a plastic wiffle ball. And you were allowed, if somebody was going between bases, you were allowed to throw the wiffle ball, and if you hit them, they were out. And this particular time, one of them threw it and hit the other one in the back of the head, and they started at each other. I still remember when Stephen was playing shortstop on the team I was coaching one time. He was about 8 years old. And somebody hit... It's a true story. Somebody hit a ball out into left field, and there was a guy on first, and it got past the left fielder, and Stephen was the shortstop, and he went out and cut the ball off. Stephen was quick, too. He cut the ball off, and the guy had round a second, was coming to round third. Stephen came running. Instead of throwing it to home, the guy got about 10 feet from home. I mean, Stephen nailed him in the middle of the back just as hard as he could throw that baseball and went, "You're out!" And I had to explain to him how that only worked in the backyard. It didn't work in real baseball. But you know, it's difficult to do in positive ways, because even sometimes when we try to make that peace and make people make peace, we use the threat. Got to sit in the corner or whatever. But that bridging the gap, making right relationships, it's not just Jesus that taught that. He built upon it. And upon what he learned from his training as a boy and a young man. But the highest task of any person was to establish right relationships. Right relationships. Because if one right relationship gets established, others can see that example, and who knows, somebody says, well, you know, I'd like to have that kind of peace. And then they seek to rectify it with someone else. Or those who make that peace then have somebody else that they know and they care about who's not that way, and they try to do it. Of course, now that doesn't mean it's always going to be successful. There are people who will not listen, and there are people who tell you they are listening, and as soon as you turn your back, they stick the tongue out at you and they go ahead and do it anyway. But blessed are the peacemakers, not the peaceful, but those who actively seek to make peace. And the first place they start is within themselves, between themselves and God. And the next place they start is between themselves and the next person that they've had a difficult run-in with.
Now, wait a minute, Ariel.
That's okay. Now I said that, and the trains jump to track, right? Yeah. Well, there was much about initiating it and teaching from a very early age. But there also was that sense where they would teach, but you made peace with your friends, you made peace with your family, but you killed your enemies. And Jesus said, wait a minute, you got to pray for them too and seek to make peace for them too. That's just like I was recently talking with someone. I had read an article, and we talked about the whole thing with Islam and the Quran. And you know, the Quran teaches, on one hand, teaches that religion is never to be forced or coerced, and that the only time you ever use violence against another person is if they are attacking Allah and the Quran, and you're seeking to defend them. And yet, there's another place in the teachings of Muhammad and later in the Quran where it says that if you try to convert your enemy and your enemy refuses, then you should just absolutely wipe them out and obliterate them from the face of the earth. So, you know, we've got a dichotomy there, but we also had that in the New Testament. We have in the way we interpret the New Testament or in religion as a whole. But yes, they did try to do that. And it is rare. In fact, I could probably count on less than one hand the number of times I ever saw my father raise his voice to get mad at anybody. Now, my mama would use a switch in a heartbeat, but my father wouldn't. I never heard a cross word or a raised voice out of my grandfather Hearn. Now, he'd tell us, no, this is Sunday afternoon, this is Sabbath, and you cannot go out there and swing, and you cannot play board games, and you cannot watch TV in my house. You can sit here and talk with your cousins, or you can come in here with the old people and listen. But I never, other things, I never heard a cross word. And I remember when I was doing my second master's, my master of theology, and had to defend my thesis against a faculty committee. I looked up Max Rogers in Durham on my way to Wake Forest, North Carolina, the town of Wake Forest, where Southeastern is. Max, well, the diaphragm had broken on his 49 Studebaker, and the mechanic couldn't find one readily, and so Max called me and said, can you pick me up in the morning? If you're ever driving down Highway 98, which was a two-lane road between Durham and Wake Forest, and the traffic was 35 to 37 miles an hour and about 2 miles long, you could bet Max Rogers was at the front in his Studebaker. We got driving along, and he said, I've told y'all some of y'all this story before. He said, Hearn, Burlington. He said, you didn't happen to know a Mr. Luther Hearn? I said, yeah, it was my grandfather. He said, well, I grew up in Burlington until I was 13. He said, Mr. Luther Hearn worked at such and such a grocery store. I said, yes. He said, my mama used to say that if it wasn't for him, that man would never, the owner would never have any business, because nobody had put up with him. But Mr. Luther was nice to everybody. It didn't matter who it was, and did everything he could to help. And then we talked about some other folks that we knew in the area and all that kind of stuff. And I thought, hey, this is going to be a piece of cake. Yeah, we got there for my oral defense, and Max said, I don't want to ask you a question. I'd just like to dialogue with you a minute about something you said in your thesis here. What do you really mean by that? Oh, well, what about... 45 minutes later, he and I finished dialoguing. But you know, that kind of person. And yet, as much as I never heard that, and my grandfather was, as far as I knew, a man of peace, I'm sure there were times that he probably wasn't. But he taught my father's whole attitude was learned from his father. And so I think you're right in a way that a lot of times these days we don't do that. We don't bring children up in that kind of situation. And sometimes we try and try to protect them, and then when they get out in other places, they run into other things and don't know how to handle it. And sometimes... Oh, yes. Well, no, but she didn't. And so, you know, I think that's really, that is really, but I think that's a valid observation. We oftentimes don't do that, and it's... Right. Yes, Susan. No. No. No, it doesn't. No, and that's why I said, well, it's not just the peace lover or the peaceful person. It's the one who makes peace even through struggle. And it doesn't mean that you let yourself be walked on. Yeah. Oh, he did. Righteous anger. Yeah. No, I think you're correct. It doesn't mean it's about making peace through struggle, but it doesn't mean that we let ourselves be walked on and become a doormat. Jesus, and according to the Gospel of John, Jesus sat down and thought about it. He made a whip of cords before he went wading in there, and not only turned over the tables and everything, but started beating people too. Because of the abuse that he saw. So it's really a difficult thing. But those who are peacemakers shall be called the children of God. One of the rabbis taught that those who create shalom will deserve to be called the children of God because they imitate God's magnanimity. The reward, then, is also how one is known. That is, as a child, literally, huioi, sons of God. God desires peace. We don't always get it because we don't follow through and desire it as much as God. God desires peace for all and sets example as He reconciles us to Himself. It's also a Jewish manner. It says, they shall be called a child of God or children of God. Literally, it is huioi, sons. Which is, you know, because it's got the masculine plural ending, but that also has something to do with male dominance in the culture. But children of God is a better translation. The Jewish manner of describing a person often is with the son of, followed by the noun, such as son of peace. Instead of saying a peaceful man, he's a son of peace. That is, he's a son of the one who seeks, bless you, to have taught him that peace, or a child of. Which also means we imitate. Your word a while ago to be initiated or imitated. We imitate. You know, imitation is the highest form of flattery, supposedly. But we imitate. Although, and I do have, and I've never read all the way through it. I've read major portions of it, but Thomas Aquinas of the Imitation of Christ. And it can be a tough read, and it's a tough challenge. And I forget one of the popes. Was it Paul or Paul II or somebody? They found him. He had died of a heart attack, evidently, but they found him in his room. And for a while, I told folks, I said, hey, you need to avoid that thing. On his chest was an open copy of the book, Thomas Aquinas of the Imitation of Christ. He was about halfway through. He was reading it when he died. I said, maybe it scared him to death. But but it does mean an imitation of a littler, a smaller version or a mirror image of that person, if you're a child of the nature and the actions of the Father. The peacemakers will be called children of God because they imitate God's desire. They imitate God's nature. We seek peace because God seeks peace. It? Peace? It's no. It, right. No, peace is not just the absence of conflict. It's not just quiet. I think peace is proper relationships, right relationships, give and take in a proper relationship. creates a sense of well-being, but not just well-being for me, but well-being for the other person. Not a false sense of that, but things are right with the world. Well, maybe not with the world, but they're right, they're proper between these two, and they're proper then between these two, and maybe a larger circle. That's really what I think peace is. It's not the absence of conflict. It's not on Walden Pond. But it is finding that place where there is proper relationship, and at least in that relationship, there is give and take, and there's mutuality in all of that, so that there's not this major conflict. Now, that also doesn't mean that you might not have a disagreement with that person, but because of the proper relationship, it can be handled in a way that doesn't destroy. And I think that's another thing about peace. We seek to not destroy in the process, in those relationships, and in the process of making peace. We try to find positive ways. And sometimes, before we get to the positive, we have to accentuate the negative. Almost sounds like we make a song about that. But yes. Those who make right relationships. I think so. They're doing the very work in which God is engaged. Ben Witherington, quote here, said, those who do it are like they're chips off the old block. That's the phrase he used. Those peacemakers are chips off the old block, making right relationships as God makes right relationships. But sometimes trying to do that almost seems futile, does it not? That's F-U-T-I-L-E, although it could end up being F-E-U-D-A-L, futile as well. But they almost seem to be futile. Witherington notes, though, in a commentary by Smith that he wrote on Matthew for Smith Elwes Press, quote, "But their work is never unsuccessful. Their living testimony to God's intended shalom keeps the vision alive." End of quote. And if we continue to work for that shalom, and we find that peace in right relationship with one other person or two other people or a dozen other people, that in itself keeps the hope alive that other people might see that example and someday make right relationship, and then someone else makes right relationship. Not because of who we are, but because within us and within our living and imitating God on seeking that kind of peace and right relationship, reconciliation to make right what was wrong, what was difficult, what separated us. And it was God. And the interesting thing is we never reconcile God to us in the biblical text. The biblical text never speaks that we have reconciled God to us. It's always God who does the reconciling. That in so doing, if we do that and we imitate God in that fashion, then perhaps the world will become a better place, at least a small part of it. And the hope is, and no, I'm not going to sound like Jesse. The hope is that, like concentric circles in a pond, it'll move further out and move further out and move further out. But even concentric circles in a pond, there has to be a pebble that starts it. Has to be a pebble. It's the small things, actually, that make right relationships more than the big things. Now, that wasn't thunder. That was my stump at that time. So. Anyone else? I appreciate your input.
Here's the piece from the relationship is going to be everlasting. Peace. Knowing how God divides that peace.
They can have it to an extent, yes. The unfortunate thing is that we as human beings, and of course this should not be used as an excuse then, we can't always accomplish, so we might as well not even try and just enjoy life. in other ways. The unfortunate thing is, while we may have right relationship and peace with one and peace with God because of our human nature and our tendency to make a wrong decision here and there and a wrong turn, it's a constant work even within ourselves, which means that between others and us, each of us, it's an ongoing. Well, he did, and he suffered for it. I mean, he could have done something more about it, but that was the manner chosen by which to bring redemption in a different way as a possibility. Yeah. Through him, he reconciled. Oh, no. No, I don't think he had complete peace as in being peaceful. He prayed for those at the same... I'm sure there was anguish when he looked down and saw his mother standing there, probably crying her soul out in front of him. And when he said, "Woman, behold your son," the disciple standing there, the one that slipped out from the others where they were hiding, he said, "Behold your mother." I'm sure that it gave him great pain and anguish in his own heart and soul to see that and to have to do that. At the same time, I think, and I could be totally wrong on this, but I think part of that saying too is that he was trying, in his anguish and in her anguish, he was trying to give her a sense of understanding and some sense of peace when he said, "Behold, woman, behold your son. Remember, this is why I came. Behold." Oh yeah, anguish. Three times. He had peace, ultimately had peace with the decision that he made, but peace and the reconciliation came through struggle. And the greatest of struggles. And, you know, my God, why have you forgotten me or forsaken me? That's a human anguish. You can. Right, Connie. Right. That's when you're correct. We seek to overcome, and part of overcoming and part of finding peace is having that closure. And resurrection gave that. There was a partial closure, though. I mean, we would have to admit at the point where he breathed his last physically, the body was at peace at that point. And there are stages to peace, to ultimate peace. It's not something that all of a sudden, boom, and it happens. But I think there are steps and stages to peace. And sometimes we get close and we back up, and then we get part of the way there and we totter up for a while and then we move on. And I think resolution to the conflict, whatever the conflict is, is ultimately a part of peace. But then after that's resolved, there are times where we have to do the difficult work of maintaining peace, maintaining relationship. Because, I've got this good, right relationship with this person. We can't just ignore it and then go off to something else. Because if we don't maintain it, then that's going to fall apart and it's not going to be that peace. So for lasting peace, it's ongoing work. And it's not easy. If you don't have a vision of peace and a vision of right relationship, then the likelihood that you'll find that is severely diminished. And it is, and even there with the vision, as you say, the first time you get this, and then the second time this, and you know, we don't have peace with people one time by saying, "Yo, I'm sorry, I forgive you," because we still have that conflict of remembering or not, and sometimes that remembrance brings up old feelings and tensions. And well, actually, that, and we take that as a formula oftentimes, but in the Hebrew text, it's actually no more than eye for eye, tooth for tooth, limb for limb, stripe for stripe. It was to be a limit on vengeance. Because somebody cuts your hand off, you get mad enough to kill them. Well, that's overkill.
You're talking about different
peace,
huh?
Yeah, you're talking about different.
That's a
yeah.
piece.
Yeah, P-I-E-C-E. Yeah, that's P-I, yeah. But even there, where's the peace? Yeah, even there, it works at peace, even with restitution, and that's where that came in too. No more than eye for eye, tooth for tooth, limb for limb, stripe for stripe. For example, Robert Phillips puts out Robert Elrod's right eye. According to the Lex Talionis, the law of retaliation, the Lex Talionis, Robert Elrod could demand that Robert's eye be put out. His right eye be put out. Well, just so happens, Robert's blind in his left eye. He can only see out of one. Robert Elrod can still see out of an eye. To put out his other eye would be considered overkill, because now he can't see at all, but Robert can still see. And so that's where this system of restitution, monetary and otherwise, developed, given those kinds of situations. So it didn't mean he had to put out an eye, but no more than an eye. And it was, the punishment was supposed to be closer to the crime. You know, if
they
cut off one hand for stealing, well, in some countries they cut the other one off too if you got caught a second time. But the Lex Talionis said you don't have to. You still got your hand. So he would have to pay money or animals or whatever, or service for that. But even there, does that mean there's peace? That takes an awful lot of work to make peace out of that. So, you know, I mean, this is an ongoing thing that the most peaceful-looking person can be filled with inner turmoil to the point that they really have no peace. And the one that looks like they're helter-skelter might have more peace in right relationships with numerous people than we know. So it's incumbent upon each of us to seek to make peace through making right relationships and then maintaining those while we seek to make peace in other relationships. It's like it's almost like, don't see them much anymore, but in those juggling acts and the other things where you'd have somebody spinning plates on the end of poles and they kept running around all these different plates trying to keep the plate spinning so that it wouldn't fall and break. Well, that's kind of how we are with relations, right relationships, and being peacemakers. We don't make it if we make peace with just one person. It means all relationships, we seek to have right relationships and make peace and then maintain those. We have to keep the plate spinning. Otherwise, we have broken relationships and there is no peace. So it's a lifelong work. And that in itself adds to the difficulty. Because we like to finish things. Right, Connie? We like to finish things and have them tied up in a nice, neat little bow. We like to finish things, but with humans, it's very difficult to finish things. You ever had anybody, and I know I've run way over, and we're going to go to choir practice in just a moment, but you ever had anybody to stand, or maybe even some of us have felt this way, to stand beside a casket or a graveside or a table, beside of a bed of someone who's just died, and say, you know, if I'd only had a little more time, I could have said this or done that and made this right. Your next sneeze could kill you, because your heart stops and it's got to start again. All the more reason not to hold one in, because it puts added pressure. Thank you. Go make peace. God bless you. Amen.